it propagates considerably slower than the speed of light. A 50 feet of waveguide, I don't know the exact number, but it might, in your particular experiment, act like it's 65 feet long. The signal goes down the waveguide slower because it is bouncing back and forth in a zigzag angle. It doesn't go down there straight. Each of those straight paths are moving at the speed of light, but the zigzag takes extra time. Traveling, it really is traveling 65 feet of length, in my example, for 50 feet of waveguide. As I said, I don't know the exact numbers, but those are the approximate ballpark. And there's a bunch of formulas you can go to that will tell you that exactly. So the way that signal goes down the guide, and the way it's taught in our electrical engineering classes, where you have these boundary conditions called the edges of the guide, you got a bunch of formulas you plug a bunch of numbers into, and you now calculate the impedance of the guide, the velocity of the guide, the phase velocity, the group velocity, and whatever. And they don't give you very many diagrams of what's really happening. Let me drop this. That scissor diagram, for instance, I found one single text. And that textbook happened to be in the library of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. I saw one book that gave you that scissor-like diagram to give you a warm feeling as to how that signal really goes down there. The other books don't tell you that. That's what it's really doing. The books don't tell you. The way we teach wireless engineering needs a lot of improvement, in my opinion. Because man is a visual animal. You got to give a person a picture of what's happening. You give a guy a bunch of equations that he's got to memorize. He's not going to retain that. So maybe that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW, the tech man. Oh, I didn't really answer the question. I told you how the waveguide, the coax adapter, is carefully adjusted so that you see 50 ohms on the coax input. The waveguide itself does have what's called a characteristic impedance. And I've forgotten the exact numbers. I think the round waveguide has a characteristic impedance greater than 377 ohms. And the rectangular waveguide, I think, has a characteristic impedance less than 377 ohms. That's the reality. In other words, at the center of the guide, you measure the voltage. At the edge of the guide, you measure the current. If you go through the right mathematics, you come up with these numbers. And the way the wave goes down rectangular guide and the way the wave goes down circular guide is the identical procedure, the identical bouncing back and forth. It's very difficult to envision those curved, the mirrors that you see in the barbershop, the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall, it's got a bunch of mirrors. And you look at the mirrors at a 45-degree angle, you're going to see the barber at the last chair three or four times in a row because of the bouncing back and forth of your line of sight to those mirrors. Well, the wave going down a rectangular guide does that. And if you slowly change the waveguide to go from rectangular, and you slowly pound on it with a ball-peen hammer and slowly make it into round, the signal goes down there the exact same way, zigzagging back and forth. It's very difficult to envision how it bounces left and right off of those curved walls and how that signal gets all put back together when it's bouncing off a curved wall. If you and I used a curved mirror to look at yourself in the morning, you would get a very distorted image. The way that waveguide operates, that so-called distorted image at each bounce, gets
repeater, time out.
A couple of wavelengths downrange, that distorted image of its bouncing off a curved wall gets reassembled into the exact same original signal. That's hard to believe. Because of the mathematics of the way you define round waveguide and the way you define rectangular waveguide, you have a different set of subscripts. In one case, you call the TE10 mode for rectangular waveguide, dominant mode, TE10. And for round waveguide, they call it the TE11 circular mode. What looks like different mathematics, what looks like a different mode, is the identical mode, just a different way of defining it. That's a tough one to accept. The impedance gets higher when you go to round. But since you never see that impedance directly, it's almost academic. In the case of coaxial cable, yes, by way of your antenna tuner and whatever, you see that impedance launch a signal into waveguide, in almost all cases, is a waveguide to coax adapter, and you're feeding that adapter. If that adapter is properly designed for the frequency region where you're using it, you see to feel. Maybe that helps. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net. There's more to the story. What else is new? Mr. JJ, I think it's John. Go ahead, John.
Mr. JJ, why would one use waveguide instead of just some more going?
A waveguide has got a hell of a lot lower loss. For you to use a piece of coax cable in a big enough diameter with air-filled dielectric and a semiconductor big enough so that it remains 50 ohms, it would be a very large diameter thing. Waveguide has got much, much lower loss per lens. That's the good news. The bad news is you don't want to use a whole lot of it. You don't want to use a whole lot of coax cable. You don't want to use a whole lot of waveguide. If you had to transmit a signal 1 mile, and you're using 1 mile of the best coax cable you can buy, assuming money is no option, and you buy the best waveguide you can to send a signal 1 mile, you go through the actual loss calculations. In both cases, it would be crazy. You wouldn't do it. If you've got to send a signal 1 mile, the best way you can do it is to use a transmitting antenna through air and a receiving antenna to pick up that signal through air. At something like a mile, don't use transmission line. At something like 100 feet, absolutely. A piece of RG58 at 432 megacycles, it's got something like 16 dB per 100 feet. A piece of waveguide, which would be very big waveguide, waveguide at 432 megacycles, would have an insertion loss of a couple of tenths of a dB per 100 feet. It would look like very large air conditioning ductwork, because the waveguide has got to be a half wavelength wide or wider in order for that signal to go down there. So, waveguide is a very low loss transmission line, but in either case, don't use a lot of it. I wonder if that sort of answers the question, John. Mr. JJ, K2RIW. One of my favorite puzzles is to ask a real RF maven what would be the loss of a piece of waveguide between the Earth and the Moon. Assuming that you had some way of suspending the rotary joint from the North Pole and you could really send a piece of waveguide to the Moon. First of all, why would you want to do that? In the case of, say, for instance, the LIGO experiment that was recently done, where a gravity wave of two black holes coming together, you received that gravity wave in Louisiana, and you received it in Washington State, something like 1,500 miles apart. Because of the very careful timing of the clock between those two LIGO gravity wave detecting sites, you could easily see the time delay of the wave getting one to the other, and that gave you a strong hint as to the direction of arrival of that gravity wave. So you want clocks very precisely aligned in a case like that. So if you and I have put some instrumentation on the Moon, we want to have the clock on the Moon and the clock on the Earth very precisely aligned. Well, you've got to send a signal from one to the other in order to do that alignment. Maybe it's the National Bureau Standard signal. Let me drop that. So if you could do it, it sounds very logical to send a piece of waveguide between the Earth and the Moon. Put a signal in one end of the waveguide, and what comes out of the other end would be used to align your clock. If the waveguide you're using is the very best waveguide you can buy from the Andrew Company, doing this at X-Band, WR90 waveguide, mil spec, silver plated, high quality, 20-foot lens, Andrew waveguide, the best waveguide you can buy. Hook that up between Earth and Moon. Because it's got 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet, and the number of 100 feet there are between Earth and Moon is so big, the signal will experience 50 million decibels of loss. The signal would never get there. So, a as I said before, waveguide is good stuff. Don't use a lot of it. If you're going beyond a couple hundred feet, you're probably wrong. You might even be wrong at a couple hundred feet. Most waveguide lengths are rarely beyond 50 feet, in my opinion. Well, 150 feet going up a broadcast tower. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Quicknet.
Very good, Dick. Interesting stuff. So basically, the resistive component is determined by the termination and the transmitting antenna, the quarter wave antenna. That's what is basically establishing the 50 ohms of impedance of waveguide. We have to look at those two structures. Is that correct?
Sort of a yes and a no to that, John. In the case of a piece of 50 ohm characteristic impedance coax cable, if I put a 50 ohm high quality termination at the far end, no matter what signal I send down there, the signal will go down once, get absorbed by the dummy load, and none of it reflects. If I put a dummy load of any other wave, any other number, 45 ohms or 55 ohms, I'm going to get a predictable amount of reflected signal. I'm going to get a predictable amount of standing wave ratio, no matter what frequency I put down there. And so as I change the frequency, I'll change the positions of the peaks and valleys of the standing wave ratio, of the standing wave along that transmission line, but I'm going to get a standing wave. Same thing happens with waveguide. If your particular waveguide at your operating frequency has a particular impedance, and you create a dummy load of that impedance at the far end, you get no reflections, you get no visual on the waveguide. The thing that's hard to believe is that in the case of a dummy load for coax cable, I can put my ohm meter on that dummy load and I will measure exactly 50 ohms if it's a high quality dummy load. Let me drop one. The dummy loads we make for waveguide, in almost all cases, are a sharp, pointy object of lossy material. The reason for that is as you change frequencies, the angle of bounce of all of those signals going down the waveguide changes. The only way you can have a dummy load that will absorb that signal, no matter what angle it hits it, is a long, sharp, pointy absorbing object in the waveguide. You could say the signal slowly hits the tip of the sharp, pointy absorbing object, and a little bit of it gets absorbed. And as the signal propagates down the sides of that lossy object, eventually all of it gets absorbed. So the dummy load for waveguides, your waveguide might have a characteristic impedance because it's rectangular. The real impedance might be 231 ohms. You think you're going to put a 231 ohm resistor at the far end. Well, if it was a real coaxial cable dummy load, you've got a real semiconductor and a real outer conductor, and I can put my ohm meter across it. Yes, I'd measure 231 ohms. Let me drop it. But in the case of waveguide, there is no semiconductor. Yes, I can connect to the outer conductor of the dummy load. Where do I put the other probe of my ohm meter? You can see you got a problem. So when you've got distributed signals in a microwave system called waveguide, the word impedance takes on some very funny meanings. The dummy load that does a good job has got to be a broadband thing. It's almost always built as a sharp, pointy object. Not too different than the sharp, pointy objects you've got as the pyramids of absorbing material on the walls of an anechoic chamber, an antenna testing chamber. For a very simple principle, similar principle. That flat phase front of the signal hitting the wall in your anechoic chamber first hits a sharp point and very slowly gets tapered into lower and lower impedances as the signal walks down, this flat wavefront walks down the sides of your sharp pyramids that are on that wall. It's very difficult to absorb a radio signal in a very thin, flat sheet of absorbing material. Very difficult. You've got to slowly taper that wave. You've got to slowly fool that wave into thinking that it's not being absorbed. Let me drop. It's a little bit like putting a lobster in a pot of cold water. You turn on the heat. In theory, he never knows that he's being heated. It happens so slowly. Well, in the case of that wave being absorbed in the wall of an anechoic chamber, you have to slowly absorb, you have to slowly introduce the absorbing material. You put a very flat absorbing material in there, you're going to get a very specific amount of reflection from that flat material. It doesn't matter if the absorbing material is high, low, or medium in impedance. No matter what your absorber is, in free space, and you could say that the waveguide, the signal boring down that waveguide, has some of the characteristics of a signal in waves in free space. You've got to slowly absorb, you've got to slowly introduce the absorbing material to that progressing wave if you don't want reflection. A little bit similar to a so-called Minerva line. If I've got a piece of coax cable that's 35 ohms, and I've got to make it match in a very broadband manner to another piece of cable that's 70 ohms, if I build what's called a Minerva line, Mr. Minerva is the guy who invented the technique. Any job? If I slowly change the center conductor diameter between the coax cable that's 35 ohms and the coax cable that's 70 ohms, I slowly change the diameter of the center conductor and change nothing else. If I make that change slow enough in ohms per wavelength, so to speak, in other words, it's 35 ohms at the beginning of my adapter, a foot down range of 36 ohms, another foot down range of 37 ohms, and so on. I slowly taper the cable, center conductor. If I do the taper slow enough, I'll get a perfect impedance match between the 30 ohm cable and the 70 ohm cable. If I do it slow enough, I get a perfect match. RF energy is kind of funny. You can do anything you want to it, as long as you do it slow enough in dBs per wavelength, ohms per wavelength, or whatever. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Big Net.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yeah, that about answers it. Very nice. I like that idea of the taper, because I assume the taper is most effective because that scissor action of the waveform going down is striking that absorbing material many times before it reaches the end, where it absorbs all of it. Good stuff. All right, I think we should go over to Paul. It's only, we've eaten up a lot of time. Okay, let's go over to Paul and see what's happening in space. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Elon Musk has been doing great things. The Kepler data is doing great things. We're finding more and more potential livable exoplanets. And Musk is recovering his, what's the word for it now, his boosters. And as you probably know, the European Observatory, extremely large telescope that they've already committed to build, unfortunately it's not going to be first light until the year 2024, but they're going to build a telescope 39 meters in diameter and located in on top of a mountain in Chile. That's going to have tremendous number of extra square feet of capture area compared to Hubble. You see the side-by-side diagram of the reflector of Hubble versus this extremely large 39 meters diameter telescope. That's what? 120 feet almost. Can you imagine an optical telescope with a mirror 120 feet in diameter? Wow. WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW. Over to you, Paul, with what I think is space report number 203 of the series. You've got it, Paul.
Yes, you're right. We're up to 203. This is WS2N. And I saw a couple of the articles with that telescope. It blew the top of the mountain off just to lay the foundation for that. So, we'll see. I mean, it's all segmented. They've all copied the Keck telescope. Since that worked out, they're all going that way, including the James Webb Space Telescope. I think that's got 18 mirrors attached to it. So, yeah, okay, I wanted to talk about reusable boosters. In some cases, it's space planes. Even India is just getting into the act. They launched a reusable space plane prototype, smaller version of what they plan on doing eventually, 5 times larger. But I mean, it looks like a small space shuttle. And they attach it to the top of a solid booster rocket. And they launched it to a suborbital flight and landed into the Bay of Bengal. But it did work out, and they just wanted to see how the aerodynamics were. One step in eventually 4 or 5 steps to eventually have a recoverable, not only first stage, but a second stage. I mean, everybody's getting into the act of dropping. And it was successful. It reminded me of the old HERMS project that European Space Agency wanted to do years ago. They wanted to attach a manned spacecraft on top of an Ariane 5 rocket and have that go into space. It would have been a 3-year astronaut crewed spacecraft, but they couldn't get the funding. But India's trying it out. I mean, it might be 10 or 15 years, they said, before they could develop it. Their next flight would probably come up in another year or two. Actually, it's not even going to be launched from a rocket. They want to drop it from an airplane and see if it lands on a runway. And if that works out, then the third one would be combined, the dropping of a spacecraft from an airplane, and just put that same thing on top of another rocket and launch that, see if they can land it on a runway, and then followed by actual orbital flights. But everybody's getting into that mode of thinking, including United Launch Alliance, between Bezos from Amazon.com, and like you mentioned, Elon Musk from SpaceX. These two companies right from the beginning wanted to have reusable space vehicles, and they're well on their way to doing it. But in fact, there's another company Reaction. I think it's Reaction Engines. It comes out of England. They're working on a spacecraft. They have many years doing it, but they have a Skylon program, and they work on the Sabre engine. The American Air Force likes it so much. They have a research department, and they're trying to develop the same type of engine. And the Sabre engine is an engine that you could fuel it with hydrogen and use the air in the atmosphere to get the oxygen, and then that would get up to about Mach 5, and after that the exact same engine converts over to using the same liquid hydrogen, except they'll start using the liquid oxygen that's on board to send the Skylon to orbit and eventually bring that back. So I know England has got one of these engines actually running, but they don't have it attached to a physical flying device yet. And same with the Air Force. But it might be 10 years down the road, and you might see something like that eventually developed.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Okay, I probably just timed out at the end. One other quick topic. I think I mentioned in the past the ARM project. That's the asteroid redirect mission. It's pretty much being canceled. SLS, the Space Launch System being built by NASA, will have the Orion spacecraft on top, and their goal is, of course, long-term goal is to get to Mars, but you're going to see some flights where they'll probably go into orbit around the moon. They call it cis orbit. But one of the ideas that they had, and they were putting money into it, they were developing the ARM, the asteroid redirect mission. They were going to go out to an asteroid, pluck a big boulder, you know, many, many ton boulder from the asteroid, and bring it back and put it into orbit around the moon. And once that was in orbit, a couple of, you know, years down the road, maybe 2021, 2022, they were going to launch astronauts, orbit around the moon, and dock with this asteroid that they put in orbit. In turn, go out to an EVA, bring some rocks back from the asteroid. I was never crazy about the idea of doing this. I don't know, I'm kind of glad that they canceled it. In this way, they could redirect the money to other funds involved with the Space Launch System in Orion to maybe develop a space station around the moon, or eventually put some money to setting a course to Mars. But I think the ARM mission probably would have been a distraction, and it would have diverted a lot of fun time, you know, away from what their real goal is, to try to get back to the moon and Mars. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Kind of ripping through this because they have a little low on time. I mentioned New Shepard. New Shepard is a rocket that Blue Origin has been launching. They've done it three times so far. They launch it out in Texas, goes up suborbital, goes into space, and comes back and lands vertically on a launch pad. And they've been quite successful. Every time they do this, they launch a New Shepard spacecraft from the top of this thing, and that comes down in parachutes, and that also lands properly on Earth. And that goal of Blue Origin is to carry tourists on these suborbital flights. Up to six tourists would go, maybe a couple of years from now. They're going to do a lot of testing. And the next test that's coming up, probably within a couple of weeks, I'm thinking, from what I read, is to take this New Shepard spacecraft, and instead of having three parachutes, just do it with two parachutes, just to prove that they could land the New Shepard spacecraft safely if you did have a crew and paying customers in this spacecraft, get to suborbit and come back down, you know, with two parachutes just in case one fails. So they're making some headway with launching the New Shepard. And of course the booster would come back and land as well. They have long-term goals. They are planning and building orbital rockets and spacecraft that will eventually launch from Florida. They've already taken over Launch Complex 36B, and they plan on maybe 4 or 5 years down the road launching not only spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, but again, crewed with tourists paying on board these orbital flights. Now, not to be outdone, nobody's going to outdo Elon Musk with SpaceX. Let me drop it. Friday, after a one-day, 24-hour delay, they launched the TICOM satellite to geosynchronous orbit, and that was a you know, they get paid to do that. It'll be launched it was launched successfully, and that satellite had been in communication. Satellite that will be will be because it's not there yet. It takes time to get to that location for communications. So they get paid for that, but they took that first stage booster and they wanted to again land it on the ASDS, the autonomous spaceport drone ship. Drop it. And again, this is going at a very high speed. Probably they said around a little over 8,000 kilometers, so per hour. And with that, it gains a lot of heat when it hits the atmosphere. So they tried to slow it down a little bit more than the last time they successfully did the exact same thing and landed it on the drone ship. This time they did the same exact thing. They had cameras on board on the top of the first stage, and you can see the first stage coming into the atmosphere. You can see the fins open up. They have these guiding aerodynamic fins that actuate. They open up four of them on top of the booster, and you see it come into the atmosphere, and you can see the actuator is actually moving, guiding itself eventually to where this ship is in the 400 miles out in the ocean. Remember, this thing launched from Cape Canaveral, so it's about 400 miles off the coast of Florida. So with that, it came right down to the, you saw the engines fire in the upper atmosphere before it hit the upper atmosphere. Three engines came on to slow it down. The engines turned off about 10, 15 seconds later, and then they dropped further all the way down to toward the drone ship, and then the engines came on again, and successfully landed almost dead center. I think it was about a meter off from the center of the bullseye that they have painted on the drone ship. So you can go to the website, SpaceX website, or even space.com, a couple of the other websites, they have videos of this thing. And it's amazing. He's doing a good job. That's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions from you or anybody else, I'll be here. K2RIW. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Unless you want to go to bed early tonight, Paul, I don't think you had to rush it. We still have 27 minutes or so left of our normal scheduling time. I think Elon Musk is doing a good job. I've forgotten the very next launch of a exoplanet detector, which is called TESS. And I've forgotten what TESS stands for, but it's going to be the Kepler add-on is not the right word, the successor to Kepler. Kepler looked at 150,000 stars simultaneously, and TESS, I think, is going to look at the whole darn universe simultaneously and look for blinking that takes place when a planet passes in front of that particular star. How in the world they look at all directions at once is a difficult task as I see it. Let me drop. But as such, it's going to find a lot more exoplanets. There's one estimation that the number of planets in the habitable zone around their star is roughly 20 billion. I presume that's 20 billion in our galaxy. Our galaxy is now believed to have 300 billion stars. So 20 million of them are in the habitable zone. It's not too high. It's almost 10%. Maybe the 20 billion is for the whole dot universe, not just our galaxy. But they come up with numbers like that. You got to bear in mind that only a very small fraction of the stars have planets going around them, where the plane of that planet just happens to be like a record that's aligned to our point of view, edge on, so that the planet passes directly in front of the sun, in front of that star, probably 0.1% or something like that of the planetary systems around other stars have that precise alignment. So even though we've seen a few thousand exoplanets, we're only looked at a small fraction, probably a small fraction of 1% of all of the planets that are out there, because the majority of them don't line up that way. They're running around that star, but they don't pass in front of that star from our point of view. So there's a hell of a lot of things that we're missing. Let me drop. As such, knowing that you can only see a small fraction of these blinking, you'd really like to look at all directions at once if you have the hardware. How in the world is TESS going to do that? I haven't dug into TESS enough to understand that. And I think TESS is going to be launched in the year 2022. I've forgotten what year it's being launched. Hoping for any words on that, John. Here we go, Paul. WS2N, Space Network, K2RW in the second hand.
Yeah, I think I brought that up a couple of weeks ago, but didn't spend much time on it. But that's going to be going up next year. So that's got a contract with SpaceX. They're going to put that thing up there. Probably August, I think, or September. I think the later part of next year. But that's going to be on a really interesting orbit. By the way, it was the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Transiting for T, Exoplanet for E Survey Satellite that's going to go an incredible orbit. It's never been used before by any other satellite. It's going to go out to the lunar distance, so a quarter of a million miles out, and that will be apogee, and perigee will be it's only like 60,000, I believe I read, 60,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. So the perigee will be, way above the geosynchronous orbits, which are at, 23,000. So it's over twice the distance. So I think it's around 60,000 miles. And when it gets close to the Earth, and when I say close, 60,000 miles, that's when it's going to start transmitting. So we transmit for an hour or two all the data that it received on its 13.5 orbital period. Let me drop it. So it'll go out to the, moon's orbit, and then back again around Earth every 13.6 days. Call it 13.5 days. That's why they call it a P2. P divided by 2. For the moon period divided by 2. The moon is, 28 days. So you're going to split that up. Now, in doing that, they will not get any gravitational effects from the moon, the way they have it set up. And during that time frame, they have four different cameras on board, all operating at the same time. Four CCD, charged couple devices, staring at these stars. And I guess the cameras are some form of photo meter, similar to probably what's on Kepler. I haven't looked at the details of the cameras. I know there's four of them, four telescopes that will be operating simultaneously. In the first year, area will be entirely dedicated to the northern hemisphere of the ecliptic plane, I guess you would call it. And then the next year, the south part. And then that's what it's funded to, and then you know how it is. They'll probably have extended mirrors, periods similar to what's going on with Kepler. And yeah, I'm going to throw, you know, as far as rushing time, I like to leave a lot of time for comments and questions. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
So the four cameras on board are going to look at a hemisphere, half of the sphere of the northern hemisphere, either the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere of the celestial sphere. To arrange four cameras with overlap between them, so they look at all those angles. That is one hell of a challenge compared to Kepler, where Kepler looked at a small chunk of space that was a fraction of the diameter of the moon, and it was looking at 150,000 stars in that little patch. So that's a good trick. Wow. I presume it's a consortium of the European Space Agency that's building TESS. And I think you're saying it's launched at a range around the Earth, which is considerably higher than a synchronous orbit, 22,300 miles. I'm going to make a guess it's 200,000 miles, which has half the period of the moon. So instead of 28 days, it's roughly 14 days. Obviously, that far away, nobody's ever going to go out there and repair it. Unless you can build, let me drop it. Unless you can build a robot repair mission. And I'm not hearing much sound about anybody proposing to really build the robot repair mission that goes out there and refurbishes our satellites, fills them back up with fuel and whatever, and does some component replacement. So, what's the range of tests? You told me, but I've forgotten it for half the period. It's going to be something like 200,000 miles. That's really out there a piece. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's going out to the moon orbit, which is roughly, what, a quarter of a million, 150,000 miles. I know they're going to be looking at about the same amount of stars, but in a little closer in, like you said, Kepler in the beginning just stayed at one location following the Earth in orbit. You know, that's got a different kind of orbit. It's actually in solar orbit, but following the Earth. And it was staring behind us as we went, looking at one location somewhere near Cygnus. Like you said, about the size of the moon, staring at 100,000 stars. I know this thing's going to look at twice the amount of stars, 200,000 stars. And, you know, in the beginning anyway. Who knows what's going to happen after 2 years, but 200,000 stars, I know it was the goal, and a little closer in, it's going to do a survey. Since it's going up before James Webb Space Telescope, maybe they can get some information back early. I know they'd like to use information that they get back for James Webb Space Telescope to investigate further. Because that's going to have a big 21-foot mirror on it. And for satellite repair, no, yeah, well, this thing's too far out for that, of course. Even the geosynchronous satellites are too far out. Not for long. I know SES is that big company in Luxembourg that operates at least 50 ongoing geosynchronous satellites in orbit. Is there any future? Any
repeater? Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
We're gonna have that capability. Drop it. See, either have a way to refuel it, or some kind of docking column where you can send the spacecraft out with fuel in it, dock to it, and use the fuel on the spacecraft that you just sent out to move it around and do whatever it has to do to keep it going past its standard 15-year life ability. You know, every one of these satellites that they put on geosynchronous is usually 15 years, including a TICOM 8, which SpaceX just launched the other day. So there are companies thinking about this. They haven't come up with a satellite that's going to do this, to go out and dock with it or refuel it. There's a couple of companies, including Orbital Science, that's involved with, and I believe Boeing is, which is involved with developing such a system. Back to you, Dick.
So the repair mission type robot satellites, are they on the drawing board? Have they been approved? Has construction of those begun, Paul, or is it still in the talking phase? Over to you, Paul.
Oh, and before I forget, TESS is a NASA project. Whether any other countries are involved helping us out, I'll have to check. But it's a NASA project. SES is building any future satellites with the capability of either being refueled or a docking mechanism to have a satellite dock with it and have that satellite have fuel on board to maneuver it to wherever it has to go, or both. So, you know, put it this way, the receiving end has been approved. We just haven't developed the transmitting vehicle that's going to get you out there to do it.
Okay, so the future satellites are going to be built with a docking mechanism ready to accept the robot satellites that arise to either refuel or to reposition. Has there been any talk about building a robot satellite which can repair the currently existing satellites, particularly geosynchronous? Over to you, Paul.
I haven't heard anything. I mean, years ago, I would hear or read stories that, you know, some people wanted to do that, but I don't know. I suspect those ideas are kind of like going out the window. I think they need to think ahead like SES is doing now and set it up before launch. And then once it's set up, you know, even 4, 5, 10 years from now, you know, the companies that are developing spacecraft to do the actual refueling or docking and using its own jets to put it somewhere, you know, that could come along anytime. As long as the satellites being launched today, you know, have the matching satellites go up within 15 years, I think they'll be okay. So, one other thing I want to mention, by the way, we got a orbital spacecraft going around Jupiter very shortly in July 4th, actually. So, Juno has crossed the boundary of gravitation forces between the Sun and Jupiter. So now it's starting to accelerate little by little as it gets to Jupiter instead of slowing down. Back to you, Dick.
So that's going to arrive on roughly July 4th, I think you're saying. That's when it's going to do the retro burn in order to put it into orbit. I presume that satellite is going to give us much higher resolution of Jupiter and all kinds of fancy scientific measurements, maybe even a penetrating radar, and maybe further investigation of some of the zillions of moons. I think Jupiter's got something like 63 moons. So Juno is going to do a lot more than, I've forgotten the name of the previous Jupiter orbiting satellite, which I vaguely remember they They crashed it into Jupiter at the end of life. Over to you, Paul. KQLIW in the second hand.
Yeah, that was Galileo. Yeah, they don't want to take a chance and eventually have the have Galileo hit him contaminated. Galileo wasn't really put through all the sterilization processes that some of the spacecraft are or will be. And the same holds Cassini. So Cassini is now in orbit around Saturn, has been since 2004, and they're going to deorbit that next year, probably toward the end of next year, and let that burn up in Saturn's atmosphere. Again, not to contaminate Enceladus or Titan or, you know, any of the other moons. But Juno is going to go into a polar orbit around Jupiter, where Galileo was in equatorial. And Galileo used to visit all the moons. Juno is more of a Jupiter planet investigating type of spacecraft. They're going to do, well, it was originally planned 33 orbits around the poles. Now they extended that to 36 orbits by increasing the distance a little bit away from the planet than they originally planned. All the electronics have titanium, 1-inch thick titanium protection box. So every time it goes near the radiation belts, and they have strong radiation belts on Jupiter, the electronics should stay working. Back to you, Dick.
Do you have any idea as to what extended measurement Juno is going to be making compared to what Galileo measured? Galileo gave us some beautiful photography and other kinds of magnetic field measurements, and probably Van Allen belt-like measurements. Will Juno be giving us some more resolution, deeper penetration? Will it be looking below the surface? Roughly, what is Juno going to see, Paul, that we haven't seen up till now? WS2N, K2RIW.
They have two main goals, I know, is to really try to look below the clouds and the surface. Get more details on all the, you know, the atmosphere and stuff of Jupiter. They have a lot of information, but they want a lot more, and it's going to be able to look a lot deeper. That's one of the main goals. And then the other main goal is to really study its magnetic field and the radiation belt. Of course, you know, photography is going to be phenomenal. We don't have any real good pictures of the North Pole or South Pole of Jupiter. So that's going to be fun to look at. I think they have like 11 different instruments on board, different types, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a big spacecraft. It's got these tremendous solar wings, three of them sticking out from the core of the spacecraft at roughly 120 degrees apart from one another, and each one is like 60 feet long, so kind of like end to end it's like 120 feet, and they need the solar power to power the spacecraft, where Galileo was RTG. Let me drop it. Radio isotope thermoelectric generator, as well as Cassini. But they got better with solar panels. If you look at Rosetta, that went all the way out to around the same location, not as far, but to orbit that comet. You know, that had big solar panels too. They just got better at it, and they got more efficient. If it was in orbit around Earth, it would have a tremendous amount of wattage capability. But in orbit around Jupiter, it's going to be 400 watts. But that's all they need. You know, they charge up these big lithium-ion batteries, and they'll be good to go. go, and it'll probably be in the sun most of the time anyway, being in a polar orbit. Back to you, Jack. K2RAWWS2N.
Very nice. I'm guessing the radioactive thermal generators on Galileo near the end of mission may not have been as high as 400 watts. I think the total amount of available plutonium for making radioactive thermal generators is in very limited supply. I am guessing that's one of the reasons why Juno is using solar cells. That you're going to need radioactive thermal generators to run things like Curiosity and the replacement for Curiosity, another great big Mars rover. I think they've got to be, for a whole lot of reasons, they've got to be radioactive. But I think there's a limited supply, and I bet that was one of the reasons why Juno is photovoltaic. And to put 60-foot long solar cells in three directions on Juno, that's a serious deployment problem. Can you imagine folding that all up inside of a radome at the time of launch and hope that that all unfolds correctly when you're in space and doesn't get hung up in some way as you do engine burns in order to correct the trajectory? So I am guessing the shortage of plutonium is one of the reasons that Juno chose solar voltaics. Is that possibly it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, you're right. And I think they said, I'm going to take a guess, 32 kilograms of available plutonium to do the type of work. That's all that's left. You know, unless the government has got something that they're not telling anybody about. But, I mean, that's all that's known. And, you know, they just don't turn it over to NASA very easily. I remember when they wanted to do with New Horizons, you know, it was like a standard thing where Jeff Pulser was like, please let us have more plutonium for our RTG, you know, this thing's got to go 10 years, there's no other way to do it, the solar cells aren't going to work out Pluto, you know, so they gave it to him, you know, they knew it was going to be a great mission, and it turned out it was, so they built that New Horizon all around that same idea. They knew there was a shortage, there still is a shortage, so yeah, the new rover, Mars 2020 rover will have the same RTG that Curiosity has. And you'll see like plans for the European Space Agency sending rovers to Mars in 2020 as well, and China, they're all building their rovers around solar panels. Well, we did too. We had Spirit and Opportunity and even a little rover, the Sojourner, and I went up with Pathfinder. So, you know, you gotta make do with what you got, you know. There's
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Our country, you know, powering our homes. Just getting back to you, Dick.
And we're almost out of time. The facilities that were producing plutonium, the nuclear sites in the United States, I think have stopped doing it one or two decades ago. So I think there is no more plutonium coming down the pipeline, so to speak. As we decommission nuclear weapons, I think some of them contain a small amount of plutonium. Maybe they can recover some of that. And our RTG generators, I guess the good news is that plutonium has got a very long half-life. But even the plutonium that we got, the first 2 kilograms or so, it is slowly degrading. But with that huge half-life, I guess we don't have to worry about that. I guess the RTGs lose power because the thermal generators start becoming degraded. I think that's what's going on here. But give me a repeat on that one.